All right, diving right in today. We're going way back to 1992, Oklahoma City.
Oh yeah, this one's gonna be fascinating. Buckle up.
This is the case of Wanda Jean Allen, convicted of first-degree murder for the death of her former girlfriend, Gloria Leathers.
Right outside a police station, no less. Adds a whole other layer to things, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, you've got this backdrop of law enforcement, a place that's supposed to symbolize safety and security, and then right outside it, a fatal shooting takes place. And to make things even more complex, the victim and the defendant were in a same-sex relationship at a time when that was still far from widely accepted.
Absolutely. And as if that wasn't enough to make this case stand out, you also have Allen's past. She had a prior manslaughter conviction for the death of another girlfriend.
So we're not just dealing with a whodunit here, are we?
Not even close. This case forces us to grapple with some really fundamental legal questions. Like, how do you determine self-defense when there's a history of violence? How much weight should the past carry in a present case? And how do you ensure a fair trial when societal biases are potentially at play?
That's what we're here to unpack. The legal tests, the arguments, the dissenting opinions, all of it. So let's start with the big one. Why was Wanda Jean Allen ultimately sentenced to death?
Well, the jury found two aggravating circumstances. The first, as you mentioned, was Allen's prior violent felony conviction, the manslaughter charge. Now, this is a crucial point because in capital cases, the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there are what are called aggravating circumstances that warrant the death penalty. And a prior violent felony conviction is a big one. It shows a pattern of serious criminal behavior.
Right, so they're looking for evidence that goes above and beyond just the crime at hand, something to demonstrate that this is a particularly egregious case deserving of the ultimate punishment.
Exactly. Now, the second aggravating circumstance the jury found was that Allen posed a continuing threat to society. And this is where things get really tricky.
Yeah, how do you prove someone's a continuing threat? It almost feels like predicting the future, doesn't it?
It does, and it's an aspect of capital punishment that has always been highly debated. But essentially, the court looks at the defendant's past behavior and the specific circumstances of the crime in question to try and assess the likelihood that they will commit violence again. In Allen's case, the fact that her prior manslaughter also involved the death of a girlfriend likely played a significant role in the jury's assessment of her as a continuing threat. It created a disturbing pattern, suggesting that her violence wasn't isolated, but rather indicative of a deeper propensity for harm, especially within intimate relationships.
So the past is never truly just the past, especially in the eyes of the law.
Right, and that brings us to Allen's main defense, which was self-defense. She argued that she shot Gloria Leathers to protect herself.
But that defense didn't hold up in court. Why?
This comes down to what's called the burden of proof. In a nutshell, it means who has the responsibility to prove what to the court. So in Oklahoma, when a defendant claims self-defense, they first have to present sufficient evidence to support that claim. This means demonstrating that they genuinely feared for their life or safety, and that this fear was objectively reasonable given the circumstances.
So it's not enough to just say, I was scared. You have to show the court why your fear was justified in that moment.
Exactly. And only if the defendant meets that initial threshold of presenting sufficient evidence does the burden then shift to the state, the prosecution, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't self-defense.
Got it. So in Allen's case, the court found that she didn't meet that initial burden of sufficient evidence for self-defense.
Right. Now, another important factor in evaluating a self-defense claim is the possibility of escape. Oklahoma law doesn't have a duty to retreat, meaning you're not legally required to run away from a dangerous situation if you can. However, if a reasonable person could have safely escaped the situation, the court will consider whether deadly force was truly necessary.
So the question becomes, could she have walked away? Could she have avoided the confrontation altogether?
Precisely. And if the answer is yes, then the self-defense argument weakens significantly. Now, it's worth noting that one of the dissenting judges, Justice Lane, argued that Allen did present enough evidence to warrant a jury instruction on self-defense.
Ah, so there was disagreement even within the court itself.
Absolutely. The dissent felt that the trial court should have explicitly instructed the jury that once the issue of self-defense was raised, the burden shifted to the state to disprove it. They believe the evidence, even if not overwhelming, was enough to trigger that shift in the burden of proof, and failing to instruct the jury properly on this point was a serious legal error.
So even the language used in a trial, especially in the instructions given to the jury, can have huge implications on the outcome. It's all about those fine details, the nuances of the law.
It really is. And speaking of nuances, let's move on to another highly debated aspect of this case. The evidence allowed regarding Allen's prior manslaughter conviction.
Right, because as a general rule, you can't just use someone's past crimes to paint them as a bad person and therefore more likely to have committed the current crime.
Exactly. That's called propensity evidence, and it's generally inadmissible. But there are exceptions. For instance, if evidence of a past crime is relevant to proving motive, opportunity, intent, or lack of mistake in the current case, it might be allowed. In Allen's case, the court decided to permit the evidence of the prior manslaughter conviction, likely reasoning that it was relevant to the continuing threat aggravator and potentially shed light on patterns of behavior in Allen's relationships.
So they argued that it wasn't just about painting her as a bad person, but rather about understanding the context of this particular crime.
Right. But the defense countered that the risk of prejudice was simply too high. They argued that bringing up this prior conviction, especially since it was so similar in nature, would unfairly bias the jury against Allen. They would be more likely to convict her based on her past actions, rather than focusing solely on the evidence related to Gloria Leather's death.
It's a tough call, isn't it? Trying to strike that balance between providing relevant context and avoiding undue prejudice. And this case really puts that dilemma front and center.
It does. And that balancing act becomes even more precarious when we consider another controversial piece of evidence. The testimony about Allen being perceived as the man in her relationship with Leathers.
Right, that's a tricky one. So what was the court's rationale for allowing that into evidence?
The majority opinion held that this information about the dynamics of their relationship, including how they were perceived by others, was relevant context for the jury. They saw it as a piece of the puzzle, helping them understand the events leading up to the shooting.
But of course, the dissenting opinion saw it very differently.
Absolutely. Justice Lane, in his dissent, argued that this evidence served no legitimate purpose other than to potentially bias the jury against Allen based on societal stereotypes about gender roles and same-sex relationships. The dissent felt it was a clear attempt to paint Allen in a negative light using prejudice rather than focusing on the facts of the case.
It really raises uncomfortable questions about how deeply ingrained biases, whether conscious or unconscious, can seep into legal proceedings, particularly when dealing with marginalized communities.
It's a crucial point to consider, and it's a debate that continues to this day. How do we ensure that courts remain neutral arbiters of justice, especially when societal biases are so deeply entrenched?
Shifting gears a bit, Allen's defense also brought up the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. This basically means they claimed her lawyer didn't do a good enough job representing her.
Right, but there's a very specific legal standard for proving that claim. It comes from a landmark Supreme Court case, Strickland v. Washington. Essentially, the defendant has to prove two things. First, that their attorney's performance was objectively deficient, meaning it fell below what a reasonably competent attorney would have done in that situation. And second, that this deficient performance actually prejudiced their case, meaning it likely changed the outcome of the trial.
So it's not just about showing that the lawyer made some mistakes. You have to prove that those mistakes were serious enough to have potentially altered the verdict.
Exactly. And in Allen's case, the court found that neither of those prongs was met. They didn't find evidence that her attorney's actions were objectively unreasonable, nor did they find sufficient evidence to suggest that any alleged errors actually impacted the trial's outcome.
So that avenue of appeal was essentially closed off, but we talked earlier about the dissenting opinions, especially regarding the jury instructions on self-defense. Were there any other procedural concerns raised by the judges, perhaps in their concurring opinions?
Yes, and this is an important distinction to make. Three justices, Johnson, Strubhar, and Chappell, agreed with the majority's decision to uphold Allen's conviction and sentence. However, they each wrote separate concurring opinions, emphasizing the importance of complete and accurate trial transcripts for ensuring proper appellate review and overall fairness in the system.
So they were basically saying, even if we agree with the outcome in this particular case, we need to make sure that the process itself is always above board.
Precisely. They argued that even seemingly minor errors or omissions in the trial record can have major consequences down the line, especially if a case goes up on appeal. A complete and accurate record is essential for ensuring that higher courts can properly review what happened at trial and make informed decisions.
It's a reminder that justice isn't just about the verdict itself, but also about the integrity of the process that leads to that verdict.
Right, and that every detail matters when someone's life is on the line. So, to recap for our listeners, what are some of the key takeaways from this deeply complex case?
Well, when it comes to self-defense in Oklahoma, Allen teaches us that the defendant has the initial burden to present sufficient evidence. This means showing both a genuine fear of harm and that this fear was objectively reasonable in the situation. And while there's no duty to retreat in Oklahoma, the possibility of a safe escape is a crucial factor in determining whether the use of deadly force was truly justified.
And critically, only when the defendant meets that sufficient evidence threshold does the burden shift to the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't self-defense.
And as we saw in this case, prior convictions, even for crimes other than murder, can be used as aggravating factors in capital cases. The prosecution must also convince the jury that the defendant poses an ongoing threat to society, often by pointing to a history of violence and the circumstances of the current crime.
And finally, Allen highlights the incredibly tricky balancing act courts face when dealing with evidence related to intimate relationships, especially in the context of criminal trials. How do you provide relevant context without allowing harmful stereotypes and biases to influence the jury's decision? It's a question that requires constant vigilance and careful consideration.
This case truly forces us to grapple with the complexities of self-defense, the lasting impact of past actions, and the potential for bias to infect the justice system. It's a stark reminder that the pursuit of justice is rarely straightforward and often requires us to navigate morally and legally ambiguous territory.
It does, and it leaves us with a question for you, our listener. How should courts balance the need for context with the need to protect against prejudice, especially in cases where the stakes are as high as a death sentence? It's a challenging question, but one worth pondering as we strive for a legal system that is both fair and just.